I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. A new report by the National Center on Family Homelessness is eye-opening, even shocking. One in 30 children in this country experienced homelessness at some time between 2012 and 2013. That's a pretty dramatic increase over previous years and has serious and wide-ranging consequences. Homeless kids are at risk for school problems and adjustment problems. It turns out their parents have often had to deal with their own traumas, including domestic violence and sexual abuse, when they grew up. So what can be done to help homeless children, and what can be done to ensure that they don't end up on the street when they become adults? And we have a trio of guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. And let me introduce them to you. Anne Marie Collins is Executive Director of Holy Redeemer's Health Systems Druding Center, which provides transitional housing and comprehensive support services to women and children, something she's been doing for more than 20 years. Anne Marie Collins, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Also with us is Stacey Perlman, and she's assistant professor at the University of Delaware. Her work focuses on young children, homelessness, and child welfare. Also co-edited a book called Supporting Homeless Families, Current Practices and Future Directions. Stacey Perlman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And rounding out our trio of guests is Brandon Stokes. He's a student at Community College of Philadelphia. He is currently a participant for the Magellan Leadership Group. He's a committeeman here in the city of Philadelphia. He was homeless during parts of his childhood, in fact, lived on the streets when he was just 17 years old. And Brandon Stokes, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me begin with you, Anne-Marie, and begin with this study from the National Center of Family Homelessness. One in 30 children. Now, these are not children that are homeless the entire year, but nonetheless have had times or moments of homelessness. What's behind these numbers?
I think it's a variety of things. I think nationally there's not enough affordable housing. So people that are living in poverty cannot find a place to live. And what we're finding is that most of the parents of these young children, as you mentioned, experience trauma, which impacts their ability to move forward and be successful in life.
And when we're talking about children, many of these are one and younger, right? We're talking about young children.
Well, I think the statistic shows almost, I know at our place, 80% of the children are under age 5.
Wow.
So they're very, very young.
And to you, Stacey, how do you see what's driving this? I mean, and I wonder, too, whether the recession had anything to do with this and the fact that, yes, some people have recovered from the recession, but many people have not, including many poor people or most poor people.
I think that's accurate. Certainly the recession had an influence on the number of children and families experiencing homelessness, as well as what Anne-Marie was saying about the availability of affordable housing and the impact of trauma on families.
And help us understand that. I mean, just the, I guess, the incidence of trauma and also the impact of trauma.
The incidence of trauma among families experiencing homelessness is fairly high. There was a report done by the National Center on Family Homelessness last year that demonstrated that over 90% of families had experienced at least one traumatic event. So there's high rates of domestic violence, histories of child maltreatment and child welfare involvement, neighborhood violence. So very high incidence.
And would it be that some of these parents, and I'm assuming we're talking largely moms, leaving their homes or being kicked out of their homes because of domestic violence or sexual abuse?
Among youth, there is a higher prevalence of physical abuse and sexual abuse and other forms of trauma, yes.
And I'll get to you, Brandon, in just a moment. Let me go back to you, Anne-Marie, and I'm thinking about these young children in shelters or transitional living situations, are they at risk for trauma?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the things that they found over the years is that we used to think really young children weren't impacted by by trauma. And they're really, children as young as 6 months or even younger do feel the effects of domestic violence or just the impact of poverty. Or being homeless is traumatic in and of itself, and add on all the other risk factors. And young children absolutely are experiencing that trauma.
And what does that look like for, let's say, even a six-month-old or a year-old? What does trauma look like?
It will manifest itself in attachment issues, attaching themselves with their mother or with others, sleep, you know, disturbances of sleep, emotional, you know, being able to manage their emotions, all, you know, those types of things.
Brandon, let me turn to you, and I know a little bit about you, but not a whole lot, and I know that you spent some time as a child being homeless. What is your first memory, I guess, of being homeless?
My first memory pretty much was when I was five, and basically remembering that I'm at the Salvation Army here on Broad Street, and pretty much trying to wrap my head around, you know, why I don't have a home pretty much like the normal kids in my class.
And when you said 5 years, I mean, that's pretty young to be trying to figure those things out.
Yeah.
What conclusion did you come to? Why did you think you were homeless at that time?
At that time, I really couldn't put it together. But later in my life, I found out, you know, even more details that prior event wasn't the first event, and that I was actually, you know, some people say born at Eliza Shirley's.
Okay. And what was the shelter like for you as a kid?
Very, very dreary.
Dreary.
Like, it's a place where you don't see a lot of hope. And the one thing I remember is that, you know, it's very, very chaotic, and a lot of the, you know, good, hardworking people, you can kind of see them getting, you know, burnt out a little bit.
Were you able to go to school? Were you able to attend school?
School was very, very chaotic, and alluding to what she said about attachments, that happens particularly when 1 week you're going to one school, and the next, because they place you in a different shelter, you're going to another school. Now, I know that you know, legally they're supposed to keep you in one school, but that doesn't always happen.
So how many schools do you think you attend? You're now in community college in Philadelphia, I should add, but how many schools did you attend?
A lot.
A lot? Like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, something like that?
Mm-hmm.
He used the word chaotic. I mean, that was one of the words, Brandon, that you used to describe your experience. You're nodding your head, Anne-Marie. I mean, is that sort of part of the effect on children?
Oh, absolutely. Not knowing. I think, you know, the way emergency housing or shelters are set up, just by, you know, it is, can allow itself to lend itself to chaos. You know, you've got families sharing a space, not knowing, you know, you have to go to meals when they say you have to go to meals, whether you like what they're serving or not, not knowing where you're going to go to school. It's very disruptive for the entire family. And having, you know, people watching your family adds pressure to your mother, which then can lead pressure on the children.
You're nodding your head vigorously, Stacey. Go ahead.
Just thinking about the impact from a developmental perspective that the experience has on children, in particular early on, but certainly continuing into the middle childhood and adolescent years, stability and stable relationships are really key to promoting positive development. And those relationships are with family and caregivers, but they're also with sort of the extended network that's around a child. So whether it's social supports or educational supports, and the challenges that children and families face in maintaining those stable connections.
Were you able to have relationships with people that felt like stability in your life, Brandon?
Not really, because once again, I was always transient. So, you know, it's kind of hard to make friendships.
Right.
And even more so once, you know, the other students start to pick up on, you know, certain, you know, actions that you have.
Did you keep your homelessness then from other students or people sort of outside of the shelter?
I try to, but, you know, usually teachers, I believe, are, you know, trained to try to report incidents like that to DHS. And for the students, it's pretty much them picking up on, you know, certain subtleties, like you always wear the same thing, or you have, like, you know, you can never go outside past a certain time with them. So they start to catch on, and that further isolates you.
Right, and isolation. I mean, that's another. And children are social. They need to have a social environment. Do you want to speak to that, Anne-Marie?
Well, it's, you know, it's one of the things we're looking at. We have a licensed child care center, so we have an after-school program. But one of the things we're looking at since we've been implementing the sanctuary model and trauma-informed is that our children aren't able to invite their friends over or don't want to invite their friends over after school because they're homeless. Right. And you also want to make sure that our kids don't go to school without everything that everybody else has, so that they're starting the school year with, you know, the new backpack and all the school supplies, so that they don't stand out even more. Because children know, they know we're right down the street from our elementary school. So kids from the neighborhood know when our kids are walking home if they're coming to our place.
Yeah.
And what that means for them.
You mentioned the sanctuary model. Describe what that entails for our listeners.
So it's a trauma-informed model, and it basically is changing the question. I think as a society, we sometimes say, what's wrong with that person? Why aren't they doing what they're supposed to be doing? And really flipping the question to what has happened to that person? Because if you take the time to look at what's happened to them at any point in their lives, that's probably informing how they're reacting and responding and conducting themselves in the future. And unless you address that trauma right. and help them heal from that, it's going to impact their ability to be successful.
This is a very personal question, Brandy. You don't have to answer it if you don't want to, but do you feel like you were a traumatized person? Do you feel like you had trauma in your childhood?
Oh, you know, definitely, particularly with this issue and the stress it placed on my family. And also, their ways at best, you know, trying to handle that
right.
really weren't the best. Right.
Did you kind of keep this stuff to yourself? Is that how you mm-hmm. coped with your surroundings? And
yeah, very, very isolated, very, very introverted.
Yeah. And did you feel lonely?
Yeah, because yeah. you're isolated. You can't go and talk to someone because, you know, by lieu of talking, right. you reveal your situation.
And would you have, I mean, it sounds like you would have, you could have use somebody like that, right? Someone to talk
yeah.
to. Yeah, I mean, this is tough stuff, Stacey. It's tough stuff. And we're talking about children here.
Yeah, and I think that speaking to the issue of relationships, I mean, I know some of the promising work that's happening involves really ensuring that children and youth get connected to people who can help mediate the feelings of aloneness mm-hmm. and isolation.
We're almost up on a break here. I want to pick up on this isolation thing. In fact, I pick up on something you said, Anne-Marie, about being in Seattle and sort of recognizing kids on the street, that you were absolutely convinced these are homeless kids, but no one but you sort of knew that. But let's take a very short break. Before we do that, Anne-Marie Collins, Executive Director of Holy Redeemer Health System's Druding Center, and that provides a transitional housing and support services to homeless women and their children. Stacey Perlman, Assistant Professor at the University of Delaware, focuses her work on young children, homelessness, and child welfare. Brandon Stokes, currently a student at Community College of Philadelphia studying political science. He's currently a participant for the Magellan Leadership Group, and he's been talking a bit about what it was like for him to be a child and homeless here in Philadelphia. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We're talking about what to do about child homelessness. A new report said that one of every 30 children in the United States experienced homelessness last year. That doesn't mean they were homeless the entire year, but they certainly experienced times of homelessness. And it raises a whole host of really important questions. We are talking about the next generation of Americans. And again, our guests are Brandon Stokes, Stacey Perlman, and Anne-Marie Collins. And if you want to, excuse me, join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Anne-Marie, before the show began, you were talking about being, I think it was in Seattle, mm-hmm. With family, I guess, over the Thanksgiving holiday, walking around. And you could identify the homeless teenagers that you saw there.
Yeah, it was actually over the summer. And we were, you know, just doing a quick tour of Seattle. And I was just noticing, it was really easy to notice the homeless adults, but I was noticing groups of teenagers. And I made a comment to my sister-in-law that there were homeless. And she's like, oh, no, I don't think so. And I said, oh, no, they absolutely have no place to go tonight.
And how did you know that? What did you see?
I guess it was just how they were carrying themselves and how they were interacting and just their hypervigilance of their surroundings.
You could see them looking around. Mm-hmm. I mean, just super aware of what was going on around them. Mm-hmm. And Brandon, for a while, I mean, you were homeless on the streets, what, in Philadelphia, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You were nodding your head as Anne Marie was describing what she saw. Is that what you were doing?
Yes, definitely the hypervigilance and trying as best as possible to blend in to mainstream society, whether that's, going to like the laundromat and continually, washing your clothes or, buying, new shoes. But at the end of the night, you still don't have any place to go.
So where did you go at night?
Either a park bench or, underneath a bridge, particularly when it was raining or snowing.
And how long were you on the street?
For about a year.
For about a year. Mm-hmm. Wow. Did people talk to you? I mean, strangers? Did anyone notice you, do you think?
Not really. I think the point in that is to try to...
Blend in?
Yeah, as best as possible.
Were you able to go to school at the time?
No.
No. And again, I'm back to you, Stacey, but also talking and using, I guess, Brandon mm-hmm. as an example mm-hmm. of just, the kind of isolation that homeless children feel, and especially a teenager living alone for a year on the streets of Philadelphia. Also, the kind of survival skills that you have to have.
I think what you're speaking to is certainly, from a research perspective, what we are beginning to learn about youth who are experiencing homelessness. And as Anne Marie was saying, that oftentimes people don't realize that youth are homeless because youth are trying not to be found for a number of reasons. Wanting to blend in, not wanting to come to the attention of the child welfare or other city systems. So there's a lot of effort that youth place into not being found and into remaining hidden.
I mean, did you feel like you were better off on the streets than you might have been in a shelter somewhere else? That seemed like the best place for you at the time.
At that particular time, yes.
Was safer?
Well, particularly if you're a male, I would say.
And why is that?
I think that to survive as a female is a little bit precarious, what? Particularly with, people trying to take advantage of that misfortune.
Makes sense to you, Emery?
Mm-hmm. I think also the fact of being hidden, we were talking before about you don't see homeless families on the street. You don't see a young mother with young children on the streets. When people think of homelessness, they think of, the man panhandling or a woman. They don't think of a mother or a family, a mother and a father and young children. They're hidden because they don't want to come to the light of child welfare. So they're either in the system, they're in emergency housing, or they're living doubled or tripled up with family members in a very precarious situation where they could be kicked out in a moment's notice.
Right. So there is that sort of built-in insecurity about mm-hmm. where someone is going to live. But I have to say to you, Brandon, I mean, you're now a student at Community College of Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. Take us from being on the streets as a 17-year-old to what you're doing mm-hmm. today.
Yeah, for me, the sort of like the point of transition to me was in 2010, and that's when I stayed at Covenant House here in Philadelphia in the Germantown section.
And everyone's smiling as you're saying that, Brandon, but go
Germantown
ahead.
Section, and pretty much from there, I was able to have a place of relative stability. Right. For a couple months, and I basically got the opportunity to enroll in a GED program, and this is despite massive gaps in my formal education.
Sure.
Which I pretty much supplanted through books, reading at a local library.
And I imagine you did pretty well on your GED, right?
Yeah,
I'm guessing.
Very well.
Okay, fair enough.
Scoring pretty high, nationally on their scale. Also, it was a period where I started to finally meet people who got it and people who were able to give me a voice as an advocate, particularly with Opportunities PA,
right,
which I'm a former board member. But from there, I was able to advocate on this issue and transition that into other things like politics. So I went campaigning.
Yeah.
So I went campaigning around the country for different issues and in different places like New Hampshire. Yeah, I never thought.
It's cold,
you know,
up there.
Yeah, but you know, kind of those winters prepared me. So.
Right, but you know, picking up on your story, and I'm going back both to you, Anne-Marie, and to you, Stacy, which is on the one hand, he ended up at Covenant House, and things began to come together. But there's so much that Brandon had to do for himself to get there, and also to go to the library to study to get the GED. And again, I don't mean to use you as a you know, an example here.
Template.
Yeah, but you might be used to that. But I don't want to do that. But at the same time, we make it so hard. We make it so hard for kids.
We do. And I think, you know, Stacy and I were talking earlier that these very young children have mothers who have gone through a lot of these traumatic experiences as children and adults. You know, there's a statistic that 92% of homeless women have had suffered from sexual trauma as adults. So they need just as much support. If we want to help the entire family, we have to impact two generations. We have to make sure that we're providing the children with the support, but also the mothers, and not make it so difficult for them to get the help that they need.
Yeah. And in terms of support, what kind, and I'm thinking about the mothers now, Stacy, which is, what kind of support do they need to deal with perhaps their chaotic childhood or their childhood that might have incidents or being riddled with violence and sexual abuse?
Certainly mental health supports that are geared towards helping the moms to address those traumas, but also potentially parenting supports that can address the dual generation. So in particular, with thinking about working with moms of very young children, providing parenting supports that help them to think about the experiences that the moms had as children, but that can also help them then think from a strengths-based perspective about what they're doing in terms of parenting their own children and thinking about addressing who they want to be as a parent, but also addressing educational supports, making sure that they have access to childcare, which is really key in terms of thinking about how to help the moms both get the education that they need, but also to get employment.
Sure.
So I think it needs to be a very holistic view and approach that addresses the needs that the moms have, both as individual women, but also as mothers.
And important to talk about the traumas. I mean, to be able to voice that and I guess in a sort of therapeutic setting, Anne-Marie, be able to...
I think to provide the safe atmosphere so that when they start to feel those feelings that may, you know, create chaos within them, that they have a safe place to express that and to actually give them back some dignity and choice and respect. You know, give them a choice about what's happening in their lives.
Let me reintroduce the three of you. That's Anne-Marie Collins, again, Executive Director of Holy Redeemer Health Systems Druding Center, that provides a transitional housing, also support services to homeless women and their children. Stacy Perlman, Assistant Professor at the University of Delaware. Her work focuses on young children, on homelessness and child welfare. In fact, she was a recipient of the American Psychological Association's 2011 Early Career Award for outstanding contributions to the field. To the practice in the field of child maltreatment. She has edited a book called Supporting Homeless Families. And Brandon Stokes is with us as well. He's been talking about being homeless in Philadelphia as a child. He lived on the streets when he was just 17 years old, currently a student at Community College of Philadelphia and a participant for the Magellan Leadership Group. He's studying political science. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Emery, let me go back to you. And just what is transitional housing? And this is something that you're specifically involved in.
So transitional housing is part of the system that's been created so that when families leave emergency shelter or housing, either they go into permanent housing or they maybe have to go into transitional housing or permanent supportive housing. A lot of times it becomes a bottleneck because there's not enough affordable housing, so they're looking to make sure that the families that need the most intensive support are the ones that go to transitional housing so that they get the support and the encouragement so that they can move forward and be successful.
And the goal is some kind of permanent housing. And does that exist? I mean, we know in terms of rents and also Section 8 housing?
It's very, very difficult. I mean, we're fortunate. We participate in a partnership that between the City of Philadelphia and the Philadelphia Housing Authority called Blueprint. So almost all of our families move out into subsidized housing through PHA. Except for that, they can't afford fair market rent.
Right. And what in Philadelphia is not expensive like New York or San Francisco. Do you know?
I want to say for a one-bedroom, it's at least $900 a month.
Wow.
And if you only have a TANF income of $316 a month, it doesn't add up.
Where do you live now, Brandon?
In South Philadelphia.
In South Philadelphia? Mm-hmm. So you have a place, you have your own place?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what's that like for you?
Very encouraging.
Yeah.
And, you know, very stable.
And stable is that's a word I've been hearing during this hour, which is the need to know that you have a place, a roof over your head.
Mm-hmm.
Let me read an email from Ellen. My daughter and I are interested in donating to a children's shelter in Philadelphia. What does the average shelter need? Items, money, that kind of thing. Even more broadly than that, can I toss that back to you, Ellen? Mm-hmm.
Money is always good because that way you can use it where the greatest need. Books, I know we have a lending library. We're constantly promoting literacy with the children. So new children's books are always or gently used books. If you have really young children, diapers, wipes. Most places will have a wish list that will say what they need the most.
I have another email. This is from Shirley. She says, what an amazing concept looking at what happened to that person versus what is wrong with that person. And that's something that we were talking about earlier. How does that change, I guess, I'm looking at you, Stacey, how does that change how we not just think about that person, but the kind of options that might be available to that person? If we're thinking about what happened to this person versus what's wrong with them.
Well, I think it means that we are thinking about how to address the challenges that they're facing from a strengths-based perspective. If we're thinking about the kinds of experiences that someone has had, it means that we can think about, are there supports that we can put in place? Are there ways that we can work with them to address the experiences they've had in the way that seems to make the most sense from their perspective, as opposed to just simply labeling somebody as this is who you are. It opens up the possibilities for change and growth.
Yeah, you're nodding your head, Brandon.
Yeah, it takes away some of the stigmatism. Mm-hmm.
Right, just sort of feeling like like you're one of them. Mm-hmm. We also have an email from Gary. What should we do when we notice that someone is homeless? Let me put that to you, Brandon.
That's a little bit
It's tricky.
Yeah, because you don't know that particular person's frame of mind, and as she alluded to, what they've been through. So I would say the best thing to do would be to have a sense of understanding and not be so rush of judgment.
Well, maybe just a hello or some eye contact, those kinds of things. And then there's always that money issue, about whether to give money or not to a homeless person. I don't, I'm very conflicted about it. There's some I do, there's some I don't. Is there, Anne-Marie, a way through that?
I don't think there's a hard and fast rule. It's what sits well for you. I think for me, it's always making sure you make eye contact. It's a human being. Mm-hmm. Even if you're going to say no, at least look them in the eye and say no. There's several people on my drive to work, that will come up, and I just at least acknowledge them in the eye. Sometimes if I have something extra in the car, I'll hand them a banana or whatever, but I don't always, if I don't have money on me, mm-hmm. I say, I'm sorry, I don't mm-hmm. have anything. And I, you know, I think they appreciate just being acknowledged as a human being. There's also that outreach number, which it's in my phone. I don't have it memorized, but that if you do see somebody on the street, there's the outreach number that you can call.
All right. And we might be able to track that down during the break. You're also nodding your head, Stacey, in terms of acknowledging that person.
I think making eye contact, saying hello, how are you? I mean, I think to do otherwise doesn't acknowledge a basic level of humanity. And I think it's important for people to be seen mm-hmm. and visible. So I was nodding my head in agreement to acknowledging.
Does that make sense to you, Brandon?
Yes.
I mean, I think also sometimes, I'm just speaking for myself here, sometimes you feel like if you acknowledge that person and sort of get to know them, then you are starting to be responsible for them. I mean, it does open up the possibility of of a relationship. And, you know, people struggle with that, I would say. Do you agree?
Well, I think it's easier to pretend you don't see something.
Exactly.
Because if you're aware of a problem, then you really should be called to do something and address it in whatever way sits best with you. And it could be donating, it could be volunteering your time, it could be actually, you know, hands-on. But I think, you know, as human beings, we're called to take care of one another.
Yeah. Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking not just about homelessness, but the numbers of homeless children in this family, in this country, I should say. Last month, a report was released by the National Center on Family Homelessness, and it provided a pretty shocking statistic that one of every 30 children in the U.S. experienced homelessness last year. Talking with Brandon Stokes, a student at Community College of Philadelphia, spent some of his childhood or a lot of his childhood as a homeless child. Stacey Perlman is an assistant professor at University of Delaware, has been studying children homelessness and child welfare. Anne Marie Collins, executive director of Holy Redeemer Health Systems Druding Center. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499, and keep those emails coming, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. Back in 2006, one in 50 children experienced homelessness in the U.S. That's according to the National Center on Family Homelessness. Today, it's one in 30. We're talking about what explains this pretty dramatic increase and also what homeless children need. I should add that Pennsylvania and New Jersey doing better than most other states, but still there are many children, thousands of children in this region who don't have a place that they can call home. And that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. To you, Brandon, I mean, if you could roll back the clock, what would have been helpful to you as a 5, 6, 7, 8, 9-year-old?
quite easily a home.
A home. I mean, just mm-hmm. as simple as that. A home that was stable and you knew mm-hmm. you could come home to.
Yes.
I mean, that's, you know, doesn't get more simple or more mm-hmm. important mm-hmm. than that. But the idea of, I guess, not having a home and being a child, Anne Marie.
I think we've talked about the chaos that brings up for the child of just not knowing where they're going to lay their heads at night or be able to bring friends home, but also the pressure that puts on a mother of knowing that you don't have any place to take your children that's safe and secure, and that, you know, you can feeling it like a failure as a mother that you can't take care of your children.
Well, I'm wondering too, Stacey, because so broadly speaking, for children who are homeless, they are at risk for school problems, for some maybe emotional or social developmental problems. Does it make sense to, I mean, intervene as soon as possible to provide that stability for a child?
It absolutely makes sense to intervene as soon and as early as possible. Philadelphia does developmental screenings of infants and toddlers who are entering into emergency or transitional housing to assess whether or not they have developmental delays and whether or not a referral to early intervention would be beneficial, which is really important because we've done some research here in Philly that has demonstrated that children who experience homelessness for the first time as infants or toddlers, those experiences actually have an impact on how they're doing in school in second grade. And wow. So even if they move in and out of homelessness during those early years of life, we can see the impact in second grade. And in particular, what we're starting to see is that those impacts, the impact of homelessness goes beyond simply poverty alone. We recently did a study where we were able to see that the kids who had experienced homelessness relative to children who were poor but stably housed evidenced more social-emotional challenges in the classroom. And I think that's the area that we're seeing the greatest signal, if you will, in terms of challenges, is really in social-emotional.
Sure. And that puts some of the burden or onus or responsibility on teachers to be able to reach out to kids and be aware of their social and academic needs.
So one of the things I mentioned before, we have a licensed child care center that we put in place. It's called Promoting Alternative Thinking Strategies, called PATHS. And we do it with the children 3 to 5 and the school age. It's to help them identify their emotions and how to deal with them effectively and appropriately. And it's been very successful. You know, 71% of the children improve their social emotional awareness and how to deal with those emotions, because just they're not just little people. They're feeling what mom's feeling. They're experiencing everything that the adults are feeling, but just don't know how to deal with it.
I mean, that's what kids do, right? The people that they depend on, you kids watch very carefully to see how they are doing. Let me get Jeffrey from looks like Bella Vista to join us on Radio Times. Jeffrey, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I was inclined to call the show. Brandon, this is Jeffrey Carroll. How are you?
Hello, Professor.
And Jeffrey, you have to tell us who you are, just so we're all in on this. We know that Brandon knows. Go ahead.
I have a wonderful story to tell about Brandon. I teach political science at Temple University, and a couple of years ago, a mutual friend, Professor Heathfog Davis, asked if a young student from community college could sit in on my class in local government. It was Brandon, and Brandon came in one day and sat in the back of the class, approached me afterwards and wanted to know how to get involved in the political process. I gave him a couple of words of advice and went on my way. It wasn't until a couple months later we bumped into each other at a local grocery store where I shopped. And Brandon later on had become employed there. And here comes Brandon, waves me over, and then begins to follow me around the store asking me thousands of questions as I was trying to pick out all my groceries. This continued as I was doing my weekly grocery shopping there at that grocery store. We had since really gained a rapport of him wanting to know about how to get involved in issue advocacy and the political process. And I would make my weekly runs to the grocery store, and we actually became friends after 2 years of this, eventually meeting up at coffee shops and him getting advice on who to talk to about the things that he wanted to do. It wasn't until recently, though, within the last 6 months, that I found out about Brandon's story and his background. And it wasn't because he told me. It was because of one of his mutual mentors actually relayed the story about him and what he was going through at the time that he had met me. And I was completely astounded about his story. And then plus to have the perseverance and the willingness to do everything that he did and without resources, financial resources, human resources, and I was just floored, because a person like me,
I have these resources. I can't do half of the things that
you
have, Brandon.
Yeah, let me get, because Brandon, I'm looking at him while you're talking, Jeffrey. I might give him a chance to respond.
Well, thank you, Professor Carroll. Yeah, and it's been a good time learning from you. And when you asked about particularly supports that I found, you know, I definitely consider Professor Carroll one of those that I found in 2010. And even so much into the future, as I look at the goals I have before me,
right.
And particularly with looking at ways I can advocate or try to change the system. Because from my study, I don't think that particularly to change it around a little bit, government alone will find the solution.
Well, Jeffrey, I really appreciate you calling in. And he used the word persevere. I mean, clearly, mm-hmm. Brandon is determined and perseveres. I'm thinking of those kids that perhaps don't have his kinds of skills or even determination. And, you know, what do we do for those kids, Stacy?
I think it's important to think across the developmental span. And so if we're talking about young children, ensuring that if they need it, they have access to early intervention, that they have access to high-quality childcare or Head Start programs, that we do what we can very early on to support positive parent-child relationships. I think as kids move into elementary school, doing what we can, again, here's stability,
sure.
Doing what we can to both promote housing stability but also school stability. So if the family is experiencing homelessness, if the child is experiencing homelessness, doing what we can to keep them in a stable educational environment. And then I think moving into youth and adolescence, again, I think the key is relationships. So as much as possible, ensuring that the youth has a positive relationship with a parent or guardian or a teacher or an educator or a mentor who's not part of one of those places, but to really build in those supports as best we can and to do it as much as possible through relationship, and then along the way, also obviously to make sure that basic needs like food and housing
indeed
are being met.
Jeffrey, I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me toss something to you, Anne-Marie, then we'll get back to our callers, because you do follow-up. I mean, families are in this transitional housing center, and then they move on, and I know you have done follow-up. Mm-hmm. And I guess one of my questions is, based on that, what seems to work? And if we want to break the cycle of homelessness, what seems to be an effective approach?
I think Stacy has said it. It's the relationship. So our program, it's a voluntary program that will follow up with the family for up to 7 years after they move out. And longer if they need us. And it's not to build dependence on us, but it's to make sure they get connected in their community. Or if they have a rough patch, if something happens, that they know there's somebody they can call. And we may not be able to help them materially. I mean, I walked out yesterday and there was one of our graduates was sitting in the lobby talking with one of the directors who she just had a rough patch. Mm-hmm. And it was just the encouragement of, you're going to get through this. You can do it. You've come this far. You're going to get, you can continue to move forward. Because a lot of times they don't have that positive support. So it goes back to relationships.
To relationship. And that it seems like for you, Brandon, that also made a world of difference for you, maybe starting at Covenant House.
Yes, definitely. Particularly when you look at the options that I could have had, right. Because the way the system is set up, my only option out of that would have been the local men's shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about putting, you know, 17, 18-year-olds with, you know,
adult men.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think there's still, you know, much more work to do to cover the gaps within the system, to come back to what Stacy and Anne talked about with a holistic approach to solving this issue.
Let me get, looks like, is it Mitka from West Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times? Go ahead, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My name is Tamwa.
Okay. Oh, sorry.
And no worries. I've noticed that most services for the homeless are directed to women and children, but fathers are an important part of the family unit. So in directing more services to women and children, are we in essence dividing families or intentionally promoting female-headed households?
That's a very good question, and I'm tossing that to you, Aunt Anne-Marie. Go ahead.
Yeah, unfortunately, there are not enough family-friendly options. So families oftentimes are forced to separate. And one of the challenges that as providers that we have is to make sure that our programs are open and inclusive of fathers that are involved in their children's lives so that they can come and visit, they can go on trips with their children, that they're involved. And it is a challenge. I mean, it's hard enough to do what we do with the mothers and the children. To find funding to include the fathers is almost impossible.
Really?
So you do what you can with the limited resources, but it absolutely is a problem that needs to be addressed.
Do you agree with that, Brandon?
Most definitely, because as Anne alluded to, you don't see a lot of mothers, you know, with infants on the street, but you will definitely find, you know, young men, you know, around the city who don't really have anywhere else, basically no options to go.
I wonder if I can put this to you, Stacy, which is we've been focusing largely on Philadelphia or sort of the urban problem of family or child homelessness. What about rural or even suburban parts of any community? Is it also an issue there, maybe even more well hidden than in the city?
It's definitely an issue in suburban and rural areas. My understanding is that homelessness in suburban areas has actually been going up, and it's often under-recognized in rural areas just simply because there are fewer points of contact, and so homelessness in rural areas just looks very different than it does in the city. And so the numbers appear lower, but that's likely largely due to a visibility
and to invisibility
issue.
And obviously a smaller population of people anyway. So a couple minutes before I have to say goodbye to you, Anne-Marie, what can be done to prevent the increase in child homelessness? And we saw an increase over the last, you know, 6 or 7 years.
I think it needs to be a multi-pronged approach. You need to make sure that there's more affordable housing. We need to invest more in education. Education is the way out of poverty, which then impacts homelessness. Making sure that the behavioral health supports are also in place. The mental health and early, you know, when I say education, it's from the child through the adult. And the mental and behavioral health issues, making sure that people have access to the care that they need to deal with the traumas that they face.
Yeah. And what are your plans for the future, Brandon?
My plans for the future are to basically look at ways in which, they can be particularly social innovations, because that's a feature that I've looked at over the summer, and to basically see how they can help in addressing not just this issue, but a number of issues. And then after that, maybe I'll put that political science degree to use in law school, and then maybe, you know, who knows, a political career.
Well, it's been such a pleasure to meet you, and I wish you the best of luck and congratulate
you
on what you have done with your life. So thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Brandon Stokes, student at Community College of Philadelphia. He's currently a participant for the Magellan Leadership Group. And Stacy Perlman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she's assistant professor at the University of Delaware. Her work focuses on young children, homelessness, and child welfare, co-edited a book called Supporting Homeless Families. Emery Collins, thank you for joining us as well. And she's executive director of Holy Redeemer Health Systems Druding Center. And there's also a phone number. This is Project Home. If you see a homeless person and want to report them to Project Home, which takes care of homeless people, that phone number, 215-232-1984. Give them the address and they will send someone out to check on that person to make sure that they are okay. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We will be right back. And And coming up in the second hour of Radio Times, we'll be talking about the fact that Philadelphia native Bill Cosby has been under intense scrutiny over a number of past allegations of sexual assault. We'll be talking about what to make of this case, a many-pronged issue. We have a couple of guests will be joining us in just a couple of moments. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
That went well.
Yeah, your family's really cool.
Everyone loves that you stopped Uncle Rich's Ebola bomb rant.
Not so much that I'm a Dallas fan.
That is your biggest flaw. But saving dinner was awesome.
Well, if repeating something I learned on Wait, and embarrassing your great uncle is awesome.
You sounded smart for a Cowboys fan.
Oh, ha ha.
I already converted you into an NPR listener. You'll be singing Fly Eagles Fly by Christmas.
WHYY.
Every day. Everywhere.
This is WHYY-FM Philadelphia, WNJN-FM 89.7 Atlantic City, WNJZ 90.3 Cape May Courthouse, WNJB-FM 89.3 Bridgeton, WNJM 89.9 Manahawkin, and WNJS-FM 88.1 Berlin.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Comedian and actor and Philadelphia native Bill Cosby has been under intense scrutiny after numerous allegations of sexual assault came to light this fall. Today we examine the timeline of events, the media coverage of Cosby and his accusers, and how charges of rape were handled then and now. Joining us are Victor Fiorello, reporter for Philadelphia Magazine that first wrote about this controversy almost 10 years ago. Also with us, Salamisha Tillett from the University of Pennsylvania, who's been following this story, and Bruce Castor. He was DA for Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, when he decided against bringing criminal charges against Cosby. Stay with WHYY in Philadelphia for more after the news from NPR.